Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
One of the great things that currently happens if there's going to be a new school in your area is that if you're a parent that has a child that's going to be able to go to that school, well, then you're able to speak with your feet as to who should have patronage of the school. And that's what's happening in terms of Dunshaughlin in County Meath and Gorey in County Wexford. There's going to be two new secondary schools. And one of the organisations seeking patronage is KESHT. Founded in 2007, they are the Catholic Education Irish Schools Trust. So they explain to us how the process works and how parents can get involved and speak with their feet as to what type of school they would like in these two areas. I chatted to Kate Liffey about this earlier on.
And we currently are, I suppose, the biggest trust in the country. We help manage and look after over 107 Catholic voluntary secondary schools, and we're co-patrons of 34 community schools and community colleges. So that's a lot of schools, that's a lot of experience. And obviously, you know, people would know the name KESHT, but they would know about the local Mercy Secondary School or the local Presentation Secondary School, and those are the schools, those are the kinds of schools that we're trustees of.
And tell us a little bit just about the core values and how they run.
Well, that's a really good question. Like, our core values are really at the heart of everything that we do. So all of our 107 schools have a charter, and this charter, if you like, gives direction and focus and energy to the work. And at the heart of that charter are, I suppose, a number of things that we say that we treasure. So we treasure achieving quality and in teaching and learning. And, like, you know, the Department of Education inspection reports attest to this very clearly. Like, we're really, really good at this in terms of achieving the very best results for students, engaging in the most innovative and most effective teaching methodologies, a broad and rich curriculum, a broad and rich extracurricular program in schools. I mean, this is not just us saying it. This is what the Department of Education and Skills is saying in terms of inspection reports. So I think that's a key consideration for parents. Then, of course, there's other things, because it's not just about academic results. It's also about showing respect for every person. It's about creating community. It's about helping young people understand that they're called to be just and responsible, to be global citizens and to be leaders. And I think for me, perhaps coming from the faith perspective at the heart of Catholic education, is that we're about promoting spiritual and human development. We're in education because we believe a knowledge of and a personal relationship with Jesus Christ gives meaning and purpose to all of our lives. So this is what happens in KESHT schools. It happens very much in an invitational way with students, but it's at the heart of what we're about. So our schools are warm, welcoming, home away from home, that kind of a sense of a school. And I mean, they're well known.
And how does it work, Kate, in terms of there's two new schools going to be put in these areas? There's a competition now as to who will get the patronage. How does that competition work?
So this is a new system, I suppose, since about 2011. And this it's really down to parental votes. So basically in four areas, actually, in 2021, there'll be four areas, really, in the mix: Ballincollig, Bootistan, Blackrock and Dunleary, Dunshaughlin, as you said, and Gorey. And say, for example, in Dunshaughlin, parents who have children in second to sixth class in primary school would have a vote if they live in that, if you like, catchment area. So, or in that area where voting is relevant. So they literally go on the Department of Education's website, they have their child's PPS number and their air code, and they vote for the school that they want.
So it's great, because you're actually asking parents in the area what they want, because I suppose a lot of people, when they hear of two new secondary schools, Kate, and they think, oh, they hear even the word patronage, they might be scratching their head saying, I thought we were trying to, you know, divest more Catholic schools and have more kind of non-denominational schools.
Well, again, that's a really important point. I mean, I think the distinction has to be made between the primary school sector and the post-primary sector. At primary, it's well known and it's well rehearsed in the media in terms of the whole divestment question. At post-primary, the landscape is very, very different. In fact, in 2018, for the first time, we saw very clearly, and this is on the Department of Education's website, the number of multi-denominational post-primary schools exceeded the number of Catholic ethos schools for the first time. Now, that's fine on a national picture, but let's go take for example, on Dunshaughlin. What does that mean? What does that kind of statistic or that kind of fact mean for the parents of Dunshaughlin? In real terms, it means that if you are a parent in Dunshaughlin or in the hinterland and you want to send your child to an excellent Catholic school, you have to get your child on a bus and you have to travel to Navan, or you have to bring your child, or you have to travel, get them on a bus to travel to send them into Castle Knock.
And are people doing that at the moment?
Oh yes, in big numbers in Dunshaughlin, this is what's happening, and it's a real shame because we all know that the very best thing for children usually is that they go to school in the locality with their friends. So, I mean, in the whole deanery of Rathoath, there is not one single Catholic voluntary secondary school. So you're talking about a huge, you know, a fairly significant geographical area where there are no Catholic schools. So in Dunshaughlin, this is a massive consideration for parents. I suppose it's not just that it's that piece, but actually, in reality, in Dunshaughlin, in terms of the competition, the school that exists in Dunshaughlin, I'm sure it's a very fine school, Dunshaughlin Community College, that patron, ETB, is seeking a second school in Dunshaughlin. So parents could be faced with the prospect in Dunshaughlin of two schools run by the same patron.
So then it's actually taking away that choice. But then I suppose as parents are the primary educators of their children, Kate, it's up to parents to speak with their feet. But do you think there's enough awareness that this competition is happening for the patronage of these schools? And, you know, because I presume different kind of patron bodies have, sometimes people are very mobilised and sometimes they're not.
Well, that's it. I suppose we're relatively new to this in Kesht, but we are learning and we are finding as we engage with parents and with priests and with teachers and principals in both Dunshaughlin and Gorey that there's a real appetite. So there is a very strong engagement from those areas.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
If a young girl from Ireland or indeed any other country in Europe was abducted and forcibly married against her will, it would be all over the front pages. Earlier on in the week, I chatted to David Turner of the Church in Chains, where he told me of this exact story happening in Pakistan, yet reports in the media are nowhere to be seen. He explained exactly what happened in the case of a young girl called Arzu.
Arzu, as you said, is a 13-year-old Christian girl, and this story began about a month ago when a neighbour, a 44-year-old Muslim man, abducted her. Now, it all happened very quickly on the 13th of October. And, you know, here in Ireland, if a young girl was kidnapped, you know, the guards would be out straight away and there would be roadblocks.
It would be all over the front pages of the papers. If this happened in any European country, David.
Indeed. But sadly, such things happen regularly in Pakistan. It's a scandal that the Pakistani government really needs to get on top of. And thankfully, civil society in Pakistan is raising its voice. But it really needs to, because it's estimated that hundreds of Christian and Hindu girls are abducted every year. And the modus operandi is exactly the same in every case. So Arzu, in this case, was kidnapped, taken away, brought before an imam, forced to convert to Islam, and then married to her abductor. And all that happened within a day or two. Like her parents, her distraught parents, of course, reported her disappearance to the local police. But 2 days after she was abducted, they were just told she'd converted and married this neighbour man called Ali Azhar, a 44-year-old man who has already had a wife. So the case then went to the High Court. And then in the decision on the 27th of October, so 2 weeks later, so quite a bit of time has passed, the High Court ruled that the marriage was valid and they granted custody of 13-year-old Arzu to Azhar. So,
and how do they decide, David, that the marriage is valid? Because, I mean, even I think for most people listening, when they think of a 44-year-old essentially targeting a 13-year-old girl and forcing her against her will to marry them, and then that in this country that would also be deemed as rape because she's 13, how is it possible that the marriage can be deemed as valid?
Well, let me just tell you what the judge said, and indeed we have on our website we have a picture of his order that was made. He said in his order that she was initially a Christian, but that she came to realise Islam was the universal religion and asked her parents to embrace it, which they refused to do, and subsequently she accepted Islam and married Azhar Ali of her own free will. So basically it's a religious judgment. It's a judgment that ignores everything that you have just been saying. I don't know how many human rights it ignores, but it's simply that the religious views of the judge trump international human rights. And so thankfully, as I mentioned, there was an outcry in Pakistan about this. And, you know, sometimes we can be just extremely discouraged as we look overseas and see countries, as you said in your introduction, where Christians don't have the right to practice their faith and when they can be in danger. And Pakistan is one of those countries. But there was a huge outcry at this judge's decision. And thankfully, the High Court then, a couple of days later, reversed its decision and the authorities were ordered to rescue Arzu. So she was taken from her abductor. Now, unfortunately, she wasn't brought back to her parents. She was brought to a women's shelter pending investigation of the case. Now, her kidnapper was ordered to be arrested, but she went to a women's shelter, and then there's been more court cases since. So last Thursday, a medical board was asked to determine her age, because this is crucial, because her abductor claimed that she was 18, and therefore, you know, what we've been talking about, child marriage and so on, wouldn't come into the picture. Her parents had official birth documents, government birth documents, showing she was 13. But the High Court again determined kind of a middle course, and they convened a medical board to determine her age. And the case goes on. Yesterday, there was another court hearing, and this medical board came back, and they said that on the evidence of the tests that they did, she's around 14 or 15. Thus, really proving that it's very likely that she is 13 years old, exactly what was stated on her birth document.
So what's going to happen next, David?
She's back at the women's shelter, and another court hearing has been scheduled for 2 weeks' time. So her parents were encouraged at yesterday's court hearing, because any positive step in a Pakistani court really is welcomed, because so often, as in the original court judgment, decisions can be solely based on a religious viewpoint and not based on the law of the land or respect for human rights. So Arzu's father yesterday said, "We thank God that the court has given a good decision. All we want is our daughter reunited with us. We need nothing else." And her mother said, "I salute the judges. May God bless them." So her parents are encouraged. We're somewhat encouraged. We would be concerned that in the women's shelter, there might well be those who would try to, friends of the abductor, who would try to pressurize Arzu. We feel, and the fact that the medical board decided that she was underage, that should have been just the end of the case, and she should have been returned to her parents. So the fact another court hearing is scheduled is maybe a cause for some concern. But we will continue to monitor this case.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Perhaps for you, being able to attend your local place of worship is an essential service. So why isn't it being seen that way? Especially as huge strides have been made to make sure that places of worship are safe. Earlier on in the week, I chatted to editor of the Irish Catholic, Michael Kelly, where he talked to us about the current situation and what can be done to try and change.
Yeah, it really is a depressing vista, the extent to which public worship has been relegated, the extent to which it has been seen as just an accessory or a luxury even by the public health authorities, that it has effectively been banned. It's not legal for Christians or members of any other religious tradition to gather together on their sacred day and worship God collectively. And I suppose what's even more galling is if you drive 100 miles up the road to Northern Ireland, it's not banned there, because the public health authorities there recognize that it is a vital thing, that gathering together as religious communities, as Christian communities in our case, is vital for people. It makes a huge contribution to spiritual well-being, to emotional well-being, to mental well-being. I mean, survey after survey, including the longitudinal study on aging in this country, shows that people who regularly attend religious ceremonies, they live happier lives, they live healthier lives, and they live longer lives. And all of this has been ignored by the public health authorities here. And you are seeing mounting disquiet about that. I'm pleased to see everyone obviously wants to take COVID-19 very seriously. Everyone wants to ensure that vulnerable people are not put at risk. But once the churches reopened on the 29th of June, we were able to show that that was the case. I mean, in my own local church, the place smelled much more of like grappa than incense, because there was so much alcohol being used on the way in. People were going to such lengths,
and all the stewards and volunteers who trained up and gave of their time to make churches really safe places.
Absolutely. And then it was huge disappointment when things were moved to level 3, and immediately all of these places had to close down. All of these religious ceremonies had to stop. All of the masses, the other gatherings had to stop. So that was hugely disappointing for all of the energy that had gone in, and hugely disheartening as well. And I think you're starting to see the pushback against that now. We had a letter signed by dozens and dozens of evangelical pastors circulating to the Taoiseach. We had the Catholic Archbishops meeting with the Taoiseach 2 weeks ago, but there still seems to be a resistance from the public health authorities and from the politicians to listen to this voice. So Archbishop Eamon Martin, the president of the Catholic Bishops Conference, writing in our newspaper, he's calling on people to talk to their TDs, to ring their TDs, to write to their TDs, to send them emails, to say that gathering together on a Sunday is a vital part of our life as a community. Because people say, oh, you know, you can tune into Mass online, or you know, you can pray at home alone yourself. What's the number one reason why college kids stop going to church? They stop going to church when they move away to college, because they no longer have a community where they go together. So, you know, their faith slowly dies when they don't have the public expression of that faith. When people say to me, you know, a Zoom Mass or an online Mass is just as good, I say, well, taking the sacramentality out of it even is calling your mom on FaceTime just as good as meeting her for a coffee and scone. No, it's not. And people instinctively understand that. But yet the government seems, at least to this point, unwilling to budge. And so we find ourselves in the situation where we have some of the most draconian restrictions on public worship in the world.
And it would be less frustrating if there was actually evidence to say, you know, churches have been linked to lots of different outbreaks and cases, but they haven't.
Well, no, absolutely not. We know that for certain, that the risk there is very limited. We know that many churches are large buildings. People can stay 2 meters apart. Even when public worship was permitted, it was set at a limit of 50 people. So there was lots of room. And we also know from the very, very detailed statistics that the Health Protection Surveillance Unit that they gather, the churches are not the problem here. Churches have not been contributing to the spread in any way. And I think it's very telling that the church leaders who have been speaking to the Taoiseach, they have consistently asked for the evidence basis on which churches and other places of worship have been closed, and they've consistently been refused that. I mean, that would lead me to believe, therefore, that the evidence doesn't exist. Because, as I say, if we do look at those statistics of clusters and outbreaks gathered by the Health Protection Surveillance Unit, churches and places of worship are not featuring there.
And that's the thing, is there isn't a rationale for it. But have we, and I know, as you've mentioned, Michael, just the various different things people can do, but perhaps to date we haven't kicked up enough of a fuss.
No, I think so. I think that, you know, religious people, by and large, are very law-abiding people. They want to follow the regulations. They obviously care about public health. They care about slowing down the spread of this dreadful virus. So I think when the restrictions were first imposed in March, we very enthusiastically embraced those restrictions. Many churches and religious communities moved to online services and ceremonies very, very quickly. And there was a bit of a novelty about it, and I might even say a little bit of a excitement about it. But we very, very quickly found out that was a poor substitute. And when the masses and other ceremonies were re-permitted then at the end of June, people really valued and realized what they'd lost. And I think that's why this time around people are kicking up more of a fuss. And I think actually what probably happened, Wendy, is we always assumed that religious ceremonies would be treated as an essential service. So whenever it came to level three, whenever it was revealed that you could go and get your hair cut, you could go and get a massage, you could go and get a pedicure, that you couldn't attend church, then people saw the fundamental injustice about that, because obviously getting your hair cut is a very close experience. You have somebody standing at the back of your neck. Well, in my case, not for very long, but in the case of people who have lots of hair, it takes a long time. So the idea that that would be safe and gathering together in a big old barracks of a church would not, I think a lot of people saw the ridiculousness of that. So I think that's why it is so important to get in touch with politicians, to get them on board about this.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
It's a privilege to be able to support Irish businesses here on Spirit Radio, and we came across a cool one last week called Post a Selfie, and it's trying to revive that lovely tradition of sending postcards but connecting it with technology. I chatted to Adrian McCusker about his business earlier on in the week, and he started off explaining where the idea came about in the first place.
Well, I suppose the genesis of Post a Selfie started off a few years ago, Wendy. As you know yourself, like, we all went through a bit of the economic crisis the last time, and it was very uncertain times. And my background is construction. I work in building sites and different construction projects. And when the downturn happened, I suppose I used to associate the post box with bills and more bills. And
I know you don't want to open it most of the time. I find it really funny because one of my kids, who's three, loves getting the post, and I think you can get it, but I don't want to open it just yet.
Well, that's exactly what we found in our survey when we were started off Post a Selfie, that a lot of people lived in dread of the postbox, myself included. Because you could be having a good day at work and you could come home, and maybe work wouldn't be as plentiful during those uncertain times, and next thing you'd be greeted with a few bills. But one day, 2016, I come home and the usual bills were greeting me, but a postcard popped out. And it was a friend of mine who had been on holidays, and he took the time to send me a postcard.
And how did it make you feel? You were delighted.
Delighted. And my son and daughter, it was the first time they'd ever seen actually a postcard coming through the post, because postcards were scarce. And the postcard moved from the table to the fridge, and it stayed on the fridge door, and then it moved to the windowsill in the kitchen. And actually, I still have that postcard. I don't have all the bills that I got, but I still have the postcard.
I know, and it's interesting, Adrian, as you say, you know, your daughter, you know, wasn't familiar with it, and how quickly such a lovely tradition isn't happening anymore. So you're really trying to revive that tradition.
That's what we're trying to do, Wendy, because we realised that, and myself included, that I take photographs on my phone every day of different family get-togethers and nice scenic shots that were together somewhere, and there they stay. And if only one of those nice get-together family photographs was converted into a postcard that could be sent to someone maybe that's not, you know, that's not in the country or away or working or whatever, you know, it would bring a smile when they come home in the evening. And that was the genesis of Post a Selfie.
And tell us a little bit then about what happened next in terms of, you got the website up and running. So from a practical perspective, how does it actually work when I go onto the site if I want to use it?
Well, we approached Storm Technologies, and they were very helpful, and they grabbed the concept fairly, you know, they got a good hands on the concept. And it's very simple. The Post a Selfie app, it's all one word, Post a Selfie. And it's available as a free download on either the Google Play Store or on the Apple iOS store.
And then what about if you're not too techie savvy? You have the app, you pick your picture, it's pretty simple to follow the steps.
Yep. Once you pick out the nice photograph from your gallery that you would like to have as the front of the postcard, well then on the next process the photograph turns around and the name and address section pops up on the app, and it just text in or type in the name and address, a short message as like a postcard about 50 letters just to say hello, how are you, and proceed down to a payment option.
And Adrian, how much does it cost then to send one?
To send a personalised postcard to anywhere in the world is $3.99, and that's inclusive of print and postage and everything.
Wow, that was my next question to you, as I think of some of my family members that are in other parts of the world, and yes, when you capture those moments that they miss, I do think there's going to be a lovely magic about them getting a photo rather than a WhatsApp message, you know, that photo on a postcard that, as you say, will be stuck up on the fridge and cherished. Now, one of the lovely things that you've decided to do, and our producer has already decided to trial the app, and she sent a postcard to her 97-year-old granny. She's in a nursing home, and you're making sure that for those who are sending postcards to nursing homes, you're offering it free of charge. It's very generous.
That's correct. If any of your listeners would like to send a postcard to anyone, anyone that's in a nursing home, if they just type in the What's Love, when you get to the end of the app, and it says Use Voucher. So if they type in the 8 letters, What's Love, in small format, that postcard will be printed and posted to any nursing home in Ireland for free.
Well, that's a really nice part of it, Adrian, and such a good idea. Have you had good feedback so far?
Yes, very positive feedback. A lot of people are using our app in this uncertain times because, as you know yourself, and we're all suffering a bit from, you know, the social distancing aspect and not being able to travel to see loved ones. A lot of people are using our app, thankfully, to send, you know, thank you cards and birthday cards and, you know, see you soon cards and thinking of you cards.
Yeah, it's such a great idea, and I always think the best business idea, as yours was, it comes out of, you know, you get that light bulb moment with something practical that you want when you had that moment of the postcard on the fridge. So well done to you, and thanks for talking to us a little bit today, Adrian, about the Post a Selfie app. Best of luck with it,
Wendy, and thank you very much, and again I wish yourself and all your listeners well.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Earlier on in the week, I spoke to the former Attorney General and now Senator Michael McDowell, and he gave us his thoughts on how he feels the government is handling the COVID pandemic. And I started off by asking Senator McDowell if he felt that the current lockdown was justified.
Well, I mean, it's really a question of what is necessary to ensure that the COVID epidemic doesn't become out of control. And so asking a question, do you think it's justified, is simply saying, you know, is what the government decided absolutely justified, or were there other and lesser things that could have been done which would equally have been justified? So it's not a binary choice like that. I mean, for instance, do I think that there is any real scientific basis for saying that you shouldn't go further than 2 or 3 kilometres from your home when you're exercising? The answer to that is I don't really think there's much basis scientifically for such a thing. You know, if you go out on a bike, does it really matter if you keep cycling in a circle near your home, or if you go out, you know, for a cycle to a dolly mount or something? You know, that kind of stuff is rather difficult to justify scientifically. And likewise, you know, if you say it's all right for people to go into a supermarket, but it's not all right to buy a pair of socks in a supermarket, I mean, what scientific basis?
And how are those decisions being made, Senator McDowell, in terms of, you know, we see in the papers, say rightly so, toy shops and especially small independent shops saying, well, how come the bike shop down the road is allowed to be open but I'm not? You know, is there some mystical science about COVID that it thrives more in one type of retail outlet than another?
Well, I mean, people tend to personalise the virus, but it needs to be a very, very clever virus if it can work out the difference between a trike and a bike and decide that, you know, Smiths can't sell you a trike, but your local bike shop can sell you a racer. I mean, these are the kind of things which are very, very difficult to justify at the edge. And I mean, going to things like, you know, whether it's permissible to play tennis at municipal tennis courts, but not to have a round of golf on a golf course without going into the clubhouse. These are kind of very arbitrary distinctions at the edge of what could be scientifically provable. And more generally, Wendy, going to the basic point, I agree with Dr. Nabarro of the World Health Organization that lockdowns are very, very serious and very, very damaging. You know, I mean, you know, when they have the effect, for instance, of curtailing health and welfare services for families with disabled children with mental disabilities or disabled adults or whatever, these things are having significant effects on people. And there are, insofar as there's a kind of a dampening down effect on cancer treatment, all of these health surveillance programs, you know, there are deaths involved in those decisions as well. If people aren't going for checkups, if they're not getting...
People are afraid to present at emergency departments, and something like 150,000 yeah. of a backlog in various cancer screenings. Who knows what the loss of life in future years from that be,
exactly.
might be.
So what I'm saying is there are consequences to a lockdown. And I mean, then there are economic and psychological and mental health consequences. And, you know, I was listening to BBC Radio the other morning, and the number of babies under the age of one who've been the subject of physical attacks, some of them lethal, at home. The incidence of that is up 20% in Britain since lockdown came into effect. So, I mean, you can't just simply say, you know, that NPHET looks at one issue, which is a significant issue. I'm not belittling it at all, the threat posed by coronavirus. But you can't just simply say that any steps that NPHET takes as justified to confront that are also justified in terms of, you know, mental health issues, increased cancer deaths and all the rest of it. These things have to be balanced, and the way they have to be balanced is by the elected politicians coming to an informed view as to the exact consequences, say, in respect of increased...
And Senator McDowell, have you been able to have an informed view? Because right now you aren't privy to all of the data that NPHET is using to give advice on these decisions. And are they doing more than being advisory to us?
Well, I think they're being quite clearly an advocacy agency as well. I mean, they brought along, say, a young doctor to describe the effects on him of having contracted COVID and the lasting effects that it had on him and the critical effects that he had in terms of his cardiac and his lung functions and all the rest of it. That's not scientific, producing one person at a press conference. That's advocacy. But the real reason, Wendy, that I am somewhat taken aback by what's happening is that there isn't total transparency. I mean, for instance, it took wound up Oireachtas Committee on COVID, Dáil Committee on COVID, to elicit the fact that if I was knocked down on a street here in Dublin and brought to hospital in extremis, and they tested me and found that I actually did have COVID, my death would go down as a COVID death in the figures, even though the proximate cause of my death was being run down by a bus or something. I mean, there are very, very arbitrary aspects to the mortality figures, and we really don't, we've never been properly told, you know, precisely what kind of person is dying, what age they are dying. There are kind of vague statistics put out that the median age of COVID deaths was in the high 80s.
So what's the answer to this, do you think? You've called for other expert groups to be able to drill down into this research. What would that mean? What would that look like?
Well, but I said, you know, there should be countervailing voices saying, you know, what are the effects of on cancer? There should be a press conference. If you're going to press conferences on COVID, you should have press conferences on cancer deaths and increased heart disease deaths and things like that. If you're going to have daily press conferences on COVID, perhaps also you should have daily press conferences on the economic effects for many, many businesses and many, many jobs. We should have people talking about the mental health effects of COVID. I mean, it's all very well to look at this through one narrow prism and say the only item on the table for discussion is containing COVID. But the people who make those decisions, and fundamentally they're politicians, they're the elected ministers, they have to put into the balance the other side effects of what they're doing, because one person's death as a side effect of the COVID restrictions is still a death. And we have to put into the balance economic realities and social realities, psychological realities, mental health realities, employment realities.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
One of the things that you might do when you have a question about your pet is you go to Dr. Google, or in this case, Vet Google. But is that the best thing to do? Well, Pete the Vet has come up with a great new website that will help you get trusted advice when it comes to looking after and caring for your pets. He told me about it earlier on in the week.
Well, basically, it was an extension of my other work in the media. I realised that everybody's moving their attention to online. People aren't watching as much television. They're still listening to radio, all right, thank goodness, but they're not buying newspapers as much. So online is the obvious place where people go to get information. And I also realized that the internet is a great way of creating an interactive place for people, so that not only do people read information, but they can also put in questions and then you can respond to them. And so we've made a very responsive website that where people can answer questions on the screen about their particular pet, and by doing that then they can generate a response from the website that gives them recommendations on what to do, and that's really what it's all about.
So yeah, it's just practical support, and as you say, Steve, you know, most people go online and all that sort of stuff, and how does it work? Do people subscribe to it then and they pay kind of a subscription?
Yes, so you can sign up for no charge. So the first 30 days is completely free, and that's just
so you can give it a whirl.
It gives people a chance to give it a whirl and see if it works for them. And after that, it's €7 a month. So we've kept the subscription fee fairly low so that, you know, people can hopefully save that money, in fact, by using the website.
And it's a really interesting idea, especially when, you know, Dr. Google is something that you're often warned against. I presume Vet Google is also something we should be warned against in terms of when there is questions that we have, that you really need to go to a trusted source and ask a vet.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I set up the website, because Dr. Google on the veterinary front is so bad. What happens is you put in the worry that you have, and you're given all the most catastrophic possible outcomes. And of course, the folk who are suppose engaging with the Google search are people who are offering answers to catastrophic problems. So you learn all about radical treatments, including surgery and chemotherapy, and it really is quite frightening. So what we've done is we put a really simple a DIY pet triage tool. What that means is once you're in our website, you put in the immediate problem that your pet has, you get asked automatically a series of questions, and based on those, you're given a recommended answer. It's a bit like if you phone a vet practice and you'll talk to a receptionist on the phone, and they'll ask you a few questions, and then they'll say to you what you need to do. Well, we've automated that on our website, and so when you get the recommended course of action, what you also get is you get links posted on the same page to all sorts of information, videos and articles about your particular problem. So you immediately get a really good briefing about what's probably going on, along with a recommendation as to whether you need to go to the vet immediately if it's something urgent, whether you need to go to the vet in the next few days if it's more of a long-term kind of problem, or indeed if you just need to monitor your pet at home and not actually take any action other than simple home treatments. So it's all about triage. That's what that particular aspect of the website does.
It's such a great idea, I have to say. And one of the things, though, that might help people, and it might not be disconnected to a question that's come in from a listener who says, a family of a new dog for the first time, neither parents grew up with dogs, any advice on making a good start? Maybe the pet planner feature would help them.
Yes, there's something called the personalised pet planner, and what it's one of my favourite features of Pet Fix Club. I know from experience that many people have the intention of doing everything right for their pet, but they don't quite know exactly what they need to do, and so they end up accidentally not quite making it. So the pet planner is an easy to use, intuitive way of basically answering aspects of your pet's lifestyle, and you know, again, answering questions that are put up on the screen, and at the end of it, then you're given a report, and that report basically covers everything from parasite control to vaccine needs, exercise, play, home dental care, nutrition, and the report for your pet is color-coded. Green means you've already got everything right, which is great. Amber means there's a few areas where you need to tweak your pet, your interactions with your pet to improve things, and red indicates areas where it's really, really important you take prompt action. For example, if a pet hadn't been wormed for over a year, it's really important for your pet's health and your family health that you do that. So you get a green, amber, and red list of recommendations, and my idea is that if everybody did that for their pets, then the national health of pets across Ireland would improve dramatically, and that's what we're trying to achieve here.
Would you have any more advice, Pete, for that question, just for someone who's gotten a dog but neither parents had dogs in their families and they want to do things right and make a good start?
Look, there's a lot to it. I genuinely would say they should go to Pet Fix Club, sign up for the 33 days and search for what do I do with my new dog, and you'll find lots of really good information there.
And one of the things as well that for other listeners who are thinking about getting an animal is there's a feature on helping people to find a pet. So how does that work?
Yes, well, we've linked up with a website called petbond.ie, PetBond, and that basically is a website that works with ethical sources of pets, whether they're rescues or breeders, and again, you put in what your requirements are, what your home situation is, and so on, and they come back with suggested possible pets that are available, and that's a really good way to make sure you avoid puppy farmers and avoid dodgy breeders of all kinds.
If we have to caveat that, I suppose, at this time of year, Pete, just finally to ask you, it would usually be the time where you'd be reminding listeners that old adage, a dog is for life, not for Christmas.
Absolutely. That's really important. If you want to give somebody something for Christmas, what you should do is wrap up a collar or a dog's feeding bowl, or indeed a membership card for Pet Fix Club. Wrap that up and give that as a gift, and be that a notice that a dog is on the way. And then a little bit later on, you know, in February, March, April, then you can get the puppy together and make a wise decision in choosing the right dog. Dogs aren't objects to be given as pets. They're sentient creatures. They're members of the family. So you have to introduce them very carefully, and Christmas is not the right time.
And there is a cost that comes with them that I think people underestimate in terms of caring for them.
Yes, there is. €1,000 a year minimum is the cost of keeping a pet.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.